Okay, so welcome, and I'm very happy now to be in Canada. So I've been on the same time zone, and so it's going to be more easy to discuss than the previous 2 weeks. So today, my plan is to finish discussing perturbation theory by discussing an issue which something that I just added in my lecture notes this weekend, but you already heard about it, which is the use of the what's called the Schwinger-Dyson equation or the quantum equation of motion. And then I start to discuss quantization of quantum field theory involving fermions and spinors that you have seen in QFT1 and QFT2 using the canonical formalism. But I'll see how one can build a formalism of a functional integral, which makes the job. Okay, so let me start, if you have no question, with this Schwinger-Dyson equation in the framework of a scalar field theory and the pi 4 theory. And you have seen already the Schwinger-Dyson equation, I think, just for the free field in some either tutorial or exercise or homework. So you should be familiar with that. Okay, so wet blackboard, that's bad things. Okay, so let's discuss this, what is called the Schwinger-Dyson equations. I'm going to discuss that in the general setting of having a theory with an action S of phi. And well, as usual, I'm going to use the Euclidean setting in order to avoid the I and the plus or minus I epsilon factors, but that's going to work the same way for the real physical quantum theory in real time. Okay, so I'm using Euclidean just for simplicity. Okay, so we have seen that generating functional for the correlation functions of the theory, namely the vacuum expectation value of the products of field operator in the theory, is defined in the functional integral formalism by this functional integral. So you have a source term, a classical source term, and this is just the standard functional integration of the whole field configuration with a weight which is exponential of minus the action. Well, I'm using h bar equal 1 because I'm not too simple for simplicity. And then you had a source term, which is plus g times phi with a compact notation that we have been discussing last week. Okay. And the action is going to be, in most cases, the phi 4 theory, but the formalism is general. So you have seen, I think, in this last week with Dan that, in fact, to use this to construct what are called the Schwinger-Dyson equation, you just made a change variable in the functional integral. So I change phi into phi prime. It's another field which is just the original field here, and then I had a variation of the field delta phi. So this is, you see, this is quantum. You integrate over it. You are still going to integrate over it. And that's just a shift in the variable of integration. So delta phi is a classical small variation. So it's a function of x. So basically, in fact, that's a delta phi of x. Okay, with x in space-time. And we make just a change variable. So that's basically a change, a translation in phi of x for each phi. And so, of course, d phi doesn't change. The measure, remember, it's a product of x of d phi of x formally. So when you make a shift, constant shift, this is the same thing as d of phi prime. That's an important property. That's a crucial property. For some theories with nonlinear measure, like in gauge theories, you have to be careful. But for this, in the case of the scalar field, that's very simple. Okay, and then, so you have to make the change writing S of phi into S of phi prime, and you see that the variation of using this thing, you see that the variation of the term S, well, minus S plus G phi is just formally, I take the derivative of that with respect to phi. So it's delta phi times the variation of the action with respect to a variation of phi. Remember, this is a function of x. And well, with a minus sign, and plus the variation of phi is just proportional to is g is j times delta phi. So you get just plus j. So this is a function of x, this is a function of x, and you integrate over x. This is a standard definition of the products of two functions, the scalar products of two functions. Okay, so when you make this change of variable, z of g is changed into d phi, the usual exponential, the exponential term for the action, and then you have this delta phi times this, which comes out here. So you end up, when you consider a very small delta phi, to a simple equation, which is that, which is just formally, it's the expectation value of delta of the action over delta phi for a given. So I compute this object, which is a function of the quantum field, minus. So the expectation value of this, when you compute this expectation value, so the functional integration keeping the g term non-zero. So that's what I denote by expectation value of some observable of the theory with g non-zero. It's just that I take as an action s minus g phi instead of s. And well, that comes from the first term. And now I move this term to the right hand side, and you just get g, which is a term which is independent of phi. And this, in this compact form, this is the compact form of the Swinger-Dyson equation. And in this compact form, you see it's valid for any kind of action you can choose. If you can compute the expectation value of this object, you get something which is just the value of the source term at a given point. Okay. So of course, this means in fact that if I evaluate this at a given point x, I get g of x. Okay. So I think you have seen that in the case of the free field, and it's going to be exactly the same for instance, the phi 4 field theory. Okay, so now, of course, that's a very compact form, so it's a bit mysterious. But now, if you take derivative with respect to the source term endpoint of this kind of equation, rather z of g times this Swinger-Dyson equation, and you divide by z of g, what you get at g equals zero, what you are going to get is the form of the Swinger-Dyson equation for the vacuum expectation value of products of operator, since each derivative with respect to the source terms gets back a phi of x1, phi of xn in the functional integral. So what you get is a form where you see when you make a derivation of g, either it acts on this term, then it just add a phi in the vacuum expectation value, or you take for at most one of them a derivative on g term. And the, you see, if you have a delta of a delta g of gx1 of g of x, that's a fundamental rule of functional derivation. This is just a delta function of x minus x1. That's a delta function in space, in space-time. It's just a fundamental formula of functional differentiation. And therefore, what you get you get the form of the Schwinger-Dyson equation for products of operator, which is just that on the left-hand side, this becomes an expectation value of the product of operator f phi of x1 up to phi of xn. But of course, you have to add this term. So you have delta of the action with respect to the variation of phi at a point x phi. And then you set g equals zero. So this is just the ordinary expectation value of some operator located at point x, which is given by the derivative of the action with respect to the field at a point x, times the product of those operators. And on the right-hand side, what do you get? Well, you are going to get all the phi that comes out from the derivative with respect to g, but for one, which acts on g, which gives the delta function. So what you are getting is that a sum over all the n points, so we get sum from I equal 1 to n, you get a delta function of x minus xi. So x is a position where you apply this operator, and xi is one of the points, because then you take a derivative with respect to g of xi. And then what remains are the other products of operators. So it's phi of x1 up to phi of xn. But you just remove, and let me check if I have some color blackboard, some color chalk. What you get is that the phi, while the color xi is just removed. So you see here you have n operator. So this is the general n plus one correlation functions involving n plus one operator. And here you have n minus one operator. So it's a this form of the Schwinger-Dyson equation, which is valid for any theory, relates the correlation function with n plus one points or n plus one operator. So with the one with n plus one minus two operators. So it removes two of the external points. Okay, so that's the general form of the Schwinger-Dyson equation. In terms of correlation function in terms of operators. So I think you have seen that, yes? You have seen that this form of the Schwinger-Dyson equation in the case of the free field. Because in the free field, what you get, switch back to the white, and for the free field, of course, the action is S of phi equal one half of integral dx d mu phi squared plus m squared phi squared. So the functional derivative of the field, the operator that you meet here is delta phi, well, I'm sorry, delta s over delta. Well, let me just maybe leave a little room so. This is just minus, so some operator plus m squared at the point x. So you see the functional derivative of the action with respect to phi at the point x is just this Klein-Gordon operator applied to the quantum operator phi of x. Okay. Okay, and then you can see that basically this object is the Klein-Gordon operator applied to one of the points of the n plus one correlation function for n plus one free field, and it gives a relation. It's a delta function times the correlation function of the n minus one x point. So what you are getting is, in fact, that's a way to derive Vick's theorem. because out of if n equal 1, you get that the derivative of the two-point function is a delta function, so that's fixed here. That's a fixed here. That gives you the propagator. If you get for n equal 3, you get a formula which relates the four-point function to delta function and two-point function that you have computed, and you make a bit of the algebra, you discover the Vick theorem for 4 points, etc. So that's a way to derive Vick theorem. Now, what's happening if you add to this, if you consider the 5-4 field theory? So then we have to add to this plus G over factorial 4, that's 24, 5-4 of X. I'm sorry, 5-4. So a functional derivative with respect to phi of this is just, that's a factor 4, so it's you get plus G over factorial 3, that's 6 times phi 3 of X. So now, let me just see what it gives for the 5-4-3. We are getting a slightly more complicated equation. Because it gives you that minus delta plus m squared apply to a correlation function phi of x times phi of x1 up to phi of xn. Plus this term, but this term, I'm going to move it on the right-hand side of the equation. You get the usual term here, sum over I to 1 to n of delta of x minus xi times the previous term, phi of x1, phi of xn, with I missing. Removed, but then you get this term which moves there, gives plus, that's a new term, or rather minus, because there was a plus g pi cube on the left hand side. I move it on the right hand side, I get a minus g divided by factorial 3, so that's 6 times the expectation value of this operator phi cube at a given point x times phi of x1 phi of xn. Okay, so now you have this correlation function. So you have a new operator, which is a phi cube operator, which is a limit when three phi come close together of the product of those three operators. We have seen that, for instance, on the example of phi squared, that this has to be, requires a bit of care, but I will not look at that and just consider what's going on for the at the level of the diagrammatics without paying attention to the existence, the possible existence of short distance singularity. Well, if you think about what this means in terms of diagrammatics, okay. Well, this is a n plus one correlation function. So it's given by the sum of all diagrams without the vacuum diagrams, but the diagrams can be disconnected. So this object is just, I can represent it by some kind of big block. So it's just this block, and this is given by the sum of a diagram. So these diagrams may contain disconnected part, but no vacuum diagrams. So here is the first external vertex, which is associated to phi of x. And here you have n vertices. So it's a function of those positions, which I'm going to keep fixed, and of this position. And this position, you take derivative with respect to the position. So you get that minus delta plus m squared of this function. That's a general correlation function. Well, it's related by two objects. First, it's given by a delta function between the two points. So it's a delta function of, so I get x and xi with a delta function here. That's a delta function. And then you get you get, of course, the sum over I, and then you have a sum over a correlation function where you have x1 up to xn. But the xi has been removed. So this is a correlation function with n plus 1 point. This is a correlation function for n minus 1 point, and this is a delta function. And then you have this term, minus g over factorial 3, of a correlation function where you have 3 phi at the same point x. So basically, you have 3 legs which are attached to the same point. And that's a correlation function of this product of 3 fields with n other fields. So what you get is a correlation function with x1 up to xn. So you see, you have a relation between this correlation function, or the Laplacian of this correlation function, between this one and here, and this big block is, of course, a n plus 3 correlation function, because here you have n legs, and here you have 3 legs. Okay. And now if you, you invert, you move the minus delta plus m squared, you take the inverse of it and move it here, what you get is that here you get the inverse of the Laplacian applied to a delta function, so you get the propagator between xi. And here you had a propagator. So this becomes an internal vertex, you see. So it tells you explicitly how the correlation function with n plus 1 point is related to the correlation function with n minus 1 point, and to a correlation function with now, this is a big correlation function with n plus 1 point, but with a g factor in addition, you see. And you see that with this form of the Schwinger-Dyson equation, you start to insert interaction vertices in the diagrammatics. And so if you consider the term with n plus 1 phi and a factor g to the power k here, so if you have a correlation function, general correlation function with k internal vertices for the phi 4 theory, it relates this correlation function, which has n minus 1 vertices, still gk vertices, because you keep only the term of order gk. Here there is a factor g, so it relates this to a correlation function with n plus 1 phi, but gk minus 1. So that's n plus 1 external legs, k internal vertices. Here, that's n minus 1 external legs k internal vertices, and here that's n plus one external vertices, but k minus one internal vertices. So iterating this Schwinger-Dyson equation, you know, you can use it as a way to generate recurrence relation between correlation function of the 5-4 theory with a different number of external legs and a different number of vertices. And that's, you can check that you recover the Feynman rules, the Feynman diagrammatics, by using this combinator, this relation. So this relation here, this relation with this new term, in fact, is another way to generate the Feynman rules and to prove, to derive the Feynman rules, the Feynman diagrammatics, without using Vick's theorem. It's, of course, completely equivalent. And everything is based on the very compact relation, which can be derived from functional integral. So I won't have time to give more details, but you can either ask one question or go into the notes and we can discuss. If you like, just send me a mail and we can discuss that more. But those Schwinger-Dyson equations are important because, in fact, it's very general. So you can write Schwinger-Dyson equation not only for theories with a scalar field, but for theories with fermions, for theory with non-abelian gauge field, even for some higher dimensional theory for gravity or whatever. It's become very complicated. So it's a very general formalism. It's non-perturbative, you see, because you can derive perturbation theory using those rules, but it's a relation which is expected to be general at the level of correlation functions. So if you have non-perturbative effects, if you want to resum perturbation theory or discover the new non-perturbative effects that you cannot understand within perturbation theory, well, the Schwinger-Dyson equation still applies. Moreover, you can build schemes of approximation to study your theory and to make approximation on its correlation function or its scattering matrix element based on approximation on the Schwinger-Dyson equation, which are different from the simple approximation, which is to assume that the coupling constant is very small. So you can build approximation for some theories, in particular in gauge theories, which are approximation, but which are expected to have some validity in a strong coupling regime. So they go beyond perturbation theory. So Schwinger-Dyson equation are very important from that respect. Finally, I can say that you are going to meet and to hear about Schwinger-Dyson equation, not only in the concept, in the field of high energy physics, but also in the field of condensed matter theory and in some other field, because of course, Schwinger-Dyson equation, you can write some of those forms for any quantum theory. So you can write Schwinger-Dyson equation and write approximation based on that for theories of, you know, of many-body quantum system, which are non-relativistic. And that's a useful tool that if you are going to study, a strongly coupled quantum systems, like atoms, cold atoms, or strongly correlated the spins in or magnets or whatever it is in condensed matter, you'll meet as one of the important tools Schwinger-Dyson equation. Okay.
Could you just explain once again how did we count the powers of the coupling constant in the different diagrams?
It's just the power of the coupling constant is given by the number of internal vertices, mm-hmm. because you have seen that that in the Feynman rule. And you see here that a G factor comes for each phi four vertices, because I had a phi cube vertices, but I plug on it a propagator. It becomes just the standard phi four theory. Phi four vertex, and you can check that all the symmetry factors and the when you count the number of ways, the number of contraction or pairings, you get everything right.
It's so but then in the last yes. diagram, it is g power k plus 1, right? Not k minus 1. That's what confused me a little.
No. Yeah, because I mean this object, so it really exists to this object. You see, if you know this
object. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I would mean, if you know this is an n plus 3 correlation function. So, and then you take a function, you take just a triplet of legs, you take a triplet of it, you merge them to make and plug an external leg to get an additional vertex. So if you know this object, I was a bit too fast. If you know this object, you derive this object just by, and then you derive this object.
Okay. Yeah.
And you can check, for instance, how do you get the simplest vertex out of this? You get this, which is a vertex of the phi cube theory, from this correlation function here, where you have you get this from this. Well, you just pair those three. And here you consider that it's a diagram with no internal vertex. So this one is just given by Vick theorem, basically, that you get something like that or some pairing. So this is Vick theorem. For the free theory, you apply that and you get this vertex. Out of other things, but you get the contribution of the single vertex with its correct combinatorial factor if you count everything. So get a factor, here you get a G over factor of 3, but you have 6 ways to build this out of pairing of 3, and therefore you get G, factor minus G, which is the rules of perturbation theory. Okay? Thank you. Okay. So I'll stop there. But if you have questions, don't be shy and just send me a mail, and then we can discuss. Okay. So now let's go to something completely different. I'm going to discuss today and tomorrow, which is, of course, a very important ingredient in quantum field theory, which is quantization for fermions. So fermions are quantum fields which obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics. So Fermi-Dirac statistics means that the commutation relation of the creation and annihilation operator of fermions must be anti-commutation relation. And let me switch to my notes, which are here. Okay. So I have to go. Perturbation theory. Yeah. Okay, you know that, for instance, for the Dirac field, which is a field that we are going to discuss, you have seen that at length in the quantization of QED and the quantization of the Dirac equation, first quantization, then second quantization, then incorporating the coupling between fermions and the electromagnetic fields to get QED. Then you have fermionic field operator, creation and annihilation operator, and typically if you have two field operators, let's call them psi at the moment, basically the correlation, well, of course they carry indices, spin indices, but a commutation relation in a Minkowski real space, instead of being a commutation relation, are anti-commutators. So this is psi of x, psi of y, plus psi of y, psi of x. If you have x and y are point in space time, and in real space time, where you have a light cone, this has to be zero here and here. So in the space-like region. So this is future. This is past, and this is a space-like region. And the causality info that the fermionic operators must anti-commute if you have a point here, x. This is x is the origin. The vector xy is space-like. That's enforced by causality. Okay. So I'm not to discuss this more, but basically the problem, if you want to treat on the same footing bosonic fields, so fields with integer spin, and fermionic spins with half integer spins on the same footing in your process of quantization, and if you use functional integral quantization for the bosons, one must find a good way to write a functional integral formalism for fermions. But the problem is that for bosons, if you have a quantum operator phi of x, you know that you are going to, by some correspondent principle, it has to be a quantum field in the functional integral. So it's a real field in the functional integral. Okay? So you write for bosons something like integral d phi of exponential of minus the action of phi. Okay, and of course the properties of real number is that they commute. If you consider phi of x, the phi of x are real numbers associated with a given function. The product phi of x times phi of y is equal to the product of phi of y times phi of x. Well, now for fermions, one would like to be able to write something like integral over psi exponential minus s psi. And for instance, for quantizing the free Dirac field, use this as the action for the Dirac field, from which you can derive as an equation of motion Dirac equation for the wave function of an electron. And then you would like to integrate over the field configuration, the fermionic fields. But this cannot be real numbers, because real numbers commute, and this object must at best anti-commute. Okay? So how can we construct a functional integral out of anti-commuting number? Well, this is a problem which has been solved in the 60s. Basically, the most advanced formalism, there were some previous work done by some physicists, I think mostly British physicists, a pair of two British physicists, but the formalism has been mostly constructed by a Russian mathematician called Berezin, and become very popular both in math and in physics. So it's called Berezin calculus and integrals. And Berezin calculus is based on a concept of anti-commuting numbers. So they are not ordinary real numbers. And they are based on something called Grassmann algebra. Well, Grassmann was a mathematician. Okay. And I'm going to explain what is a Grassmann algebra before going back to the Dirac field briefly at a mathematical level. So I'm going to explain on a very simple example what is a Grassmann algebra. Well, you can construct a Grassmann algebra on the real field, on the complex field, on some other field, or what's called division algebra, whatever. Mathematicians have a whole formalism for that, but I'm going to construct a Grassmann algebra out of a field which is a complex number for the Dirac field. One can simplicity. Well, it can be also constructed for the real field. That's useful for instance, for Weyl fermions. But I'm going to concentrate on the standard complex number because that's the Dirac field in canonical quantization is based on the complex number because the Dirac field is charge. There's a charge. It's a U1 symmetry. Okay. Because the Dirac field in the QED is represent the field associated to the electron field, so which carries a charge. Okay. So what is this Grassmann algebra? I'm considering an object that I'm going to call with a capital GN. So it's going to be an abstract mathematical algebra with in my case, 2n generators. So I remind you, for those of you who are not very familiar with algebra in mathematics, that's a very classical concept in algebra. For instance, matrices form an algebra because matrices n by n dimensional matrices are some kind of numbers. You can multiply it. Matrices, you can add matrices, you can take linear combination of matrices, but matrices do not commute. So matrices is not a real number, that's something more complicated or more general than a complex number. Okay, so I'm going to consider a Grassmann algebra with this curly capital G, which is defined by n generator. So you have 2n generators and you are going to construct the element algebra out of linear combination of products of the generator. And all that you need is to know what are the multiplication rules for the generators. Okay, so I am going to, in my notes, I define these generators by Greek letters. So the generators are labeled by I, and well, half of the generator are denoted theta, and half of generator are denoted theta bar I for reasons which are going to appear. So you have pairs of generators, and you have n pairs. Okay. And the only rules we need to know is to know that those generators, if you view them as matrices, but in fact they are not matrices, they anti-commute. So you have an addition rules, but when you multiply two generators, they anti-commute. So basically, if you take any theta and theta prime, where theta and theta prime may be any of the theta i's or the theta bar I, when you multiply them, the order is important. And when you take the sum of this product in this order and this product of this order, you always get zero. Always. So those are, in some sense, anti-commuting numbers. Well, you know how to compute to make matrices that anti-commute. You have seen that in math and in quantization of QED. for instance, the Dirac matrices have some anti-commutation relation, but the Dirac matrices do not anti-commute completely. Those numbers anti-commute even with themselves. You see. So in particular, this means that any products zero of two and any products of theta bar square are zero. Just take in particular. But in addition, a product of a theta I with a theta g or a theta I with a theta bar g is also zero. They all anti-commutes. So this is an algebra which is going, it says that all the theta are nilpotent. That's what mathematicians call nilpotent. When an element is multiplied by with itself in the algebra, then it gives always zero. Okay. So, these are the generators. And out of the generators, we are going to construct all elements. Let me denote them G of this big algebra G with n generators, G, n. Okay. And well, it's an algebra. So,
François?
Yes?
The phi squared equals zero, is this what makes it different from the Clifford algebra? Because it looks a bit similar.
Yes, because in the Clifford algebra, you know that the products of the anticommutator of a gamma mu with a gamma nu is basically up to there is a two, I think, or minus two. It's a delta. It's a g mu nu. Of course, for different gamma mu and gamma mu, they anticommute. But gamma mu, it means basically that gamma mu squared is one. So it's not an anti-commute. I'm sorry, I should look at you here. It's not an anti-commutating. It's not a Grassmann algebra. It's a Clifford algebra. There is a mathematical relation between Clifford algebra and Grassmann algebra, but they are not the same, exactly the same kind of object. They share some properties. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So. What is a general form of G? A general element of the algebra is just obtained by taking linear combination of products of those elements. So basically, a G is given by a sum of some numbers, complex number, times products of thetas. Thetas or theta bars, products. Okay, but well, since all thetas anticommutes, you know, a product of theta can contain at most only one of each generator. Zero, at most one of each generators. You see, if you have two generators, if you have the same thetas, you can use anti-commutation to bring them together, and when they multiply each other, they give zero. So, for instance, if you take n equal one, so you have two generators, theta and theta bar. Well, what are the products of generator? You can take no generator, so you get one. You can get one generators, either thetas or theta bar, or you can take the products of two generators and you can order them the way you want. You can take theta, theta bar, or theta bar theta, but theta bar theta is minus theta theta bar, so it's the same object up to a sign. So basically, a general G is just a linear combination of those terms. It's a formal definition, but so you can take, you have a coefficient A for identity, B for the coefficient of theta, C for the coefficient of theta bar, and D, where A, B, C, and D are complex numbers. So it's a formal definition, but that's enough. These are the generator algebra. So one is one of the, so you see the generators of the element are theta and theta bar. The basis of the algebra is made out of two the product. So it's an algebra which is four dimensional. So G1 is a four dimensional complex algebra. Okay. Well, in general, you can show that, in fact, the n-dimensional algebra out of this is 2 to the power 2n dimensional. See? And that's because, in fact, well, you can order them. So you can choose just, you can just take the sum of all combination when you order E1 up to I2 up to IK. You can take K thetas. You can take G1 up to G2, up to ta-ta-ta, GH, H, theta bars. And you can order the thetas before the theta bars. So you can order, you can have that the smaller theta, theta 1 is before theta 2, up to theta IK. And then you have ordered the theta bar G1 up to theta bar gk. Well, you have a coefficient associated to this sets of I and g. So let's call it ig. So that's a complex number, complex coefficient. You sum over all possible number h and k. That goes from 0 to n. So this is the basis of the algebra, where you have chosen to, as basis of algebra, as ordering all the thetas before the theta bar and in the order of their indices. You have a coefficient, complex coefficient, and that's it. So there is a unique decomposition according to this basis of the element of the algebra. Okay, and you can check that you have indeed 2 to the power 2n possible sets. So this is the general form. And now, of course, it's enough to know the anti-commuting rules. If you have two G1 and G2, you can compute G1 times G2 by just taking those two products using all the anti-commutation relations. You are going to have, if you have G1 and G2, you are going to have a product of theta, a product of theta bar, a product of theta, a product of theta bar. Then you use the anti-commutation relation to move all the thetas there. So it remains all thetas here, all theta bars here. Then you order them, and as soon as you have two thetas with the same indices, it gives zero. So it gives a lot of simplification. Okay. So this is known just out of the anti-commutation relation. So you know how to write all the elements of the algebra, and you know how to compute their products. And you know, of course, also how to write linear combination. So you have the product is known. G1 plus G2 is known. And if you want to take a linear combination, you just change the complex number here. So you know what is A G1 plus B G2. Is known, where A beats a complex number. So it's an algebra. You know the multiplication of the algebra, the multiplication rule. You know the addition rules. And you can check that this algebra, this Grassmann algebra, is associative. It means that A times, well, if you have G1 times G2, you take the products and then you multiply by Z3, this is the same thing as G1 times G2 times Z3. So it's an associative but non-commutative algebra. Okay. Okay, so finally, how much time do I have? Well, I'm almost done. So finally, I'm going to define very briefly, three objects which we are going to use for quantization of the Dirac field next Thursday. First, we are going to use as a convenient object a conjugation, which can be different from the operation, the bar. So to any G, associate a G star, which I just need the fact that in this case that's easy. It's the conjugation, the conjugate of delta I is just the delta I bar, and the conjugate of a delta bar I is just, I'm sorry, the conjugate of theta bar I is theta, theta star. The conjugate is theta I. So star is a conjugation. Why? This is something like complex conjugation, but this conjugation can be viewed as a symmetric, the symmetric. Okay, and you need then to know how the conjugation acts when you have products. And you can check that, in fact, the properties that the conjugate the products of two objects, if you use those rules, is G2 star times G1 star. So you see this conjugation is like transpose for real matrices or hermetic conjugation for complex matrices. But it's an abstract conjugation, but that's a useful tool. And you can check that with these rules, it satisfies this one. And this is enough. Okay. And finally.
The complex yes. coefficients become complex conjugate also.
Oh, of course, of course, of course. And of course, if you have a complex coefficient A, A star is just A bar. Well, in fact, mathematician likes to call a complex conjugate of a complex number A star. So that's physicist notation, in some sense, that's physics, that's mathematics. Well, in many cases, some mathematician use that. Yeah, so it's a standard complex conjugation for complex number, but you see that for real number, the conjugation is just the identity. And for complex matrices, this conjugation is just a complex conjugate. But this is an abstract conjugation. Okay. Okay. And finally, I'm going to define, but I'll go back later to next Thursday. Two important things because we want to construct integration over elements of the Grassmann algebra. So we want to construct an operation which is a derivation with respect to a generator theta I or theta bar I. So we define a derivation in the algebra. So we want to define what is d over d theta I of an element of the algebra. It's going to be another element of the algebra. And the rule is very simple. If you apply the derivation on theta I, well, it behaves like the ordinary derivation for real number. The derivative of x is 1. So the derivative of theta I with respect to theta I is just 1, the identity of the algebra. But all others, p over theta I of either theta g or theta bar g, for g different from I, or here for any g, is equal to 0. So that is just the ordinary rules of differentiation. And of course, for the same region, d over d theta bar I of theta bar I is 1, and all others are 0. OK. And you can check that this with these rules, the derivation anti-commutes. So the Schwarz rules of commutation of derivation becomes anti-commutation. So you have an anti-commutation. D over d theta I, d over d theta g, just d over d theta g times d over d theta I equal delta I g. And if you have a theta bar, it's going to give 0. So the derivation anti-commutes. So you see, so you start to have some kind of a differential calculus on anti-commuting numbers. Okay? The same for the derivation with respect to the theta bars. And if you take a d over d theta I and d over d theta bar g, it gives 0. Okay? So they anti-commute instead of commuting, but otherwise the rules of calculation are the same. Okay, and finally, we would like to define an integration. So this is something, the anti-commuting analog of the derivation with respect to a variable real number x of a function. And we would like to integrate over x for a function. And that's defined in my notes. And basically, we would like an integration so that partial integration works. So we would like an integration. We would like to have a number of the algebra which is given by the products of theta and theta bars. And we want to integrate over d theta I this number. So that we so this number contains theta i's and theta bars, thetas and theta bars. And when we integrate over theta i's, which means that the dependence of g in terms of theta I disappear. So we want to get something without this theta I. And the same for d theta bar I. Okay. And in particular, one would like that when you integrate over theta I an element of the algebra, which has been obtained by the derivative with respect to the same theta I of G, since a derivation, you see, derivation removes the theta I. So this must be equal to 0. So in some sense, this is a partial integration rule for Grassmann numbers. This is just partial differentiation. Okay, but we have seen, so we want this to be always zero, but we have seen that derivation anti-commutes already. So derivation makes a job. So in fact, integration, they are very different from differentiation in for with respect to a complex or a real number. Integration equal differentiation. So you can take as a definition with respect to integration with a delta I of something, some element of zero, but you can take by definition that it is a derivative with respect to delta I of the same number. That's enough. Okay, and you can check that, for instance, that when you integrate over theta I, the Grassmann number theta I, the generator, well, you get one. But when you integrate theta I one, you get zero. So it's very different. Etc. So derivation is somehow similar to the ordinary derivation with respect to of a function with respect to a complex number or real number, except that the derivation operation, if you have a function with several variables, they anti-commute instead of commute. But integration must satisfy those anti-commutation rules with respect to theta I, and therefore integration behaves very differently. But everything works. So you can view, in fact, you can view Gn as some kind of space of functions of 2n anti-commuting numbers, which are the theta i's and the theta bar i's. So you see, you know that the algebra of functions of the functions of n variables, n real variables, or n complex variables, if you consider analytic functions, they form an algebra. But this algebra is very simple because this algebra is commutative. Multiplication of function is commutative. And you can define derivation with respect to the variable of the function. You can define integration with respect to some of the variables, so partial integration, and calculation works. In some sense, you can view this Grassmann algebra as some anti-commuting algebra of functions of 2n anti-commuting variables, which are the generators theta I and theta bar I of the Grassmann algebra. Okay. So Grassmann algebra is an anti-commuting algebra of functions of anti-commuting numbers. But this algebra is a bit strange. But in some sense, it's much simpler because an algebra of function of simply one or two variables, it's already an infinite dimensional algebra. While the algebra, Grassmann algebra, is a finite dimensional algebra. Its dimension is 2 to the power 2 times the number of variables of the anti-commuting numbers. And that's because of the anti-commutation rules, which makes that a lot of terms disappear when you multiply elements, when you take derivatives of elements, when you take integration of elements. Okay. And this Grassmann algebra that I've defined before now is a basic tool to define a functional integral over fermionic fields. And that's, well, I'm almost done, so I should stop. We'll see that. Cool. So thank you. Sorry for being a bit late. I know there is a lecture just starting. So thank you.
Excuse me, François. Yes. Can you just repeat the anti-commutation rule for the derivative? Because you put that this product is equal to delta ij, but if we have the same I, since we know that a Grassmann number cannot have two times the same theta. If you take two times the derivative with respect to theta I, what does it mean? I mean, it gives zero anyway, no?
It gives zero anyway. So you know, if the product of two objects is zero, the products commute or anti-commute, because you make zero equal zero plus zero or zero minus zero works fine. So this part is trivial for. The non-trivial part here, for instance, here. You know, consider this object here. Sorry, I hope the guy who is not coming. Okay, consider just the one-dimensional, well, the algebra with two generators, G1. You see? Consider d over theta squared of this object. Well, d over d theta of this object here. D over d theta on one gives zero, over this gives b, over this gives zero, and over d you need to, you have a d over d theta of theta gives
d theta bar.
One, so it's d theta bar. Mm-hmm. Now if you take d over d theta of this object, you get d over d theta of this object, but this object doesn't contain any theta, so it's zero.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. That's what you said. Now consider.
But the right hand side. But the right hand side of your equation is one in that case. In the anti-commutation rule for derivative.
No, let me see that. Okay, so let me compute d over d theta bar of d over d theta of this g. Okay, you see that you take a derivative, then this one gives d plus d.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what you said. But now consider d over d theta bar over d. I'm sorry, d over d theta times d over d theta bar of g. In order to compute that, you need to, since you first apply d over d theta bar over theta theta bar, you need to just rewrite this as minus d theta bar theta. I use the anti-commutation of thetas and theta bar.
Ooh,
so now you get minus d theta, you derive with respect to d, you get minus d.
I think I just didn't see that there is a bar on the blackboard in the anti-commutation rule. I think, because...
No, that's very important. Everything anti-commutes. So basically what you have is that the d over d theta...
Yeah, I think I get it, yeah.
Times d over d theta g anti-commuting is zero. But you have also over d over d theta I anti-commutes with d over d theta bar g. And the same for the theta bar. Every derivative anti-commutes. Everything anti-commutes, basically. So theta and theta bar is just used because we have complex generators, so we'd like to define what is a complex conjugate of the Grassmann number.
Yep. Okay. So just in the formula that you wrote in the upper blackboard.
Yes.
Can you bring it back? Is there a difference with respect to what you just rewrote here?
No. If you can replace this theta bar, and that's going to be the same.
In the anti-commutation rule, it is also written. I cannot see it in the from my point of view, but yeah, I think this one. I don't see it actually on the camera, but. but I think it's
the camera is a bit I'm sorry.
Indeed, this one. So the right hand side, is it a delta or is it a zero? Is it a delta ij or is it a zero?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a terrible mistake of mine. I am sorry. This is a zero. I'm sorry. That's a mistake. Okay. Why did I vote? No, I'm very sorry. This is always zero. They all anti-commute. I'm very sorry. Thank you for spotting the mistake. Okay, that's an important. That's an important mistake I did. I don't know why.
Thanks a lot.
Yes. No, otherwise this wouldn't work. But with this definition, you can check that this is always zero. Yeah, thank you. Okay, I have to stop because I think the next lecture, some of you are going to the next lecture, but maybe it takes place in another room. I hope so. Nobody went to knock. Let me just have a look. Yeah, no. No, so I think there is a Standard Monday lecture taking place. Well, you seem to be the only one staying there. Okay.
That's so amazing. We
can have some time.
Everyone else is gone. Thanks.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. This was an important mistake. So tell your fellows that I made a mistake here. But the mistake is not in the notes. Well, I have not, well, this yeah, part is in the lecture notes of the last year. So you can find that. It's a chapter. It's not a, yeah.
Basically, the rule is to take when we have like a big set of derivatives or a big set of integration, the rule is to take the coefficient in front of the term which contains all the variables we are differentiating.
Yes, of course. Everything else. No. All the terms that contain those terms and possibly some others. And then when you integrate or when you take the derivatives, those terms disappear and it's only the remaining terms.
I agree. Yeah. If there are like terms with even more
terms,
those guys are still there. Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to stay in the so when you see when you take a derivation, the algebra becomes a smaller algebra.
Yeah. All right.
And tac. And when you take a derivative with respect to all the generators, you just get one dimensional algebra, which is complex number. And then one more, it's
collapse to zero. Yeah.
Nothing nice. It's the algebra zero, which contains only zero.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. See you on Thursday.
Yes. Well, if you want, we can have discussion before that.
Maybe I'm gonna reread the part on the effective action because those part it's a bit like calculation can be kind of simple. For instance, in the exercise set, it was kind of simple, but concepts behind and to know how everything works well. I mean, a lot of intricate little things. So maybe I'm gonna come in.
You're welcome. I agree, but the concept of the lecture is that it has to have to be more compact. So I'm explaining the basic principle, how the principle to do the calculation. But of course, for me, to understand deeply a concept requires to have been doing a lot of calculation or some calculation before grasping how everything works. Because
I read the chapter on the effective action in the Weinberg, and I am also reading the one in the Peskin and Schroeder. So as like a complementary lecture.
Yeah, well, basically this is very standard. So the notation might be a bit different and explained, but that's So you can read. Those are of course excellent textbooks. So you can use them. You can use my. I wrote them my notation independently of those textbooks.
I'm working with the three content. So if I have a question, I'm gonna come and see you.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks.
I'm now in the same time zone, so no problem.
Yeah, I just arrived because actually I'm French too.
And, I understood you were a French speaking person.
Definitely. So I just came back in Canada this weekend too.
Ah, you are the one who was left. Oh, you maybe we are in the same plane.
I don't know. It was Sunday for me.
I arrived on Saturday.
Okay.
Okay. Ah, so you are still jet lagged.